In March of 1734, the Salzburgers, religious refugees from Europe, arrived on the shores of coastal Georgia, seeking a new life in a new world. They had made their way across the ocean and then down the Savannah River to the area that had been allocated for them by James Oglethorpe. It was wooded frontier, and in March, the weather was only going to get more warm and, of course, more humid. The ground, a thin sandy coating, wasn't exactly conducive to fertility and abundant crops. There was nothing there. They were, in every conceivable way, starting at zero. One of the men leading the group of nearly 300 was Pastor Johann Martin Boltzius. And Boltzius knew this wouldn't be easy. In fact, that was part of the whole thing. Getting through the hard part and coming out on the other side was all part of this whole idea, part of their religion and their faith. For 2 years, their settlement, which would come to be known as Ebenezer, did everything they could with the land they had. But eventually, the disease, the bad crops, the horrible agriculture, the flooding river nearby, it was all too much. If the Salzburgers were going to thrive in this new world, with this new life, they would have to move. And they did move. And nearly 300 years later, the town of Ebenezer is long gone, but the symbol of their enduring faith and religion still stands. And ancestors, direct descendants of the original 300 or so people who arrived on that boat in March of 1734, are still here. Welcome to the Marked Podcast. Across Georgia, there's more than 2,000 historical markers that tell the story of a person, place, or an event from our state's past. And our digital video series explores a select few of those from Georgia's revolutionary history. And in this podcast, we're expanding on that with additional voices to help bring out the stories of these markers and the context of what they tell us about our state. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Marked, the podcast. I'm Andrew Iden, the executive producer of the Marked Project here at Georgia Public Broadcasting, where we're exploring Georgia and the people, places, and moments that really tell the bigger story of our state. And we do it all through the lens of the more than 2,000 historical roadside markers across Georgia that you've probably seen and either stopped to give a read or, like a lot of people, myself included, you looked at them, wondered what they said, and got along with your day. Well, the marker we're talking about on today's episode is a prime example of why they exist. It's about the town of Ebenezer, the original settlement founded by the Salzburgers, who came to Georgia in 1734, escaping religious persecution. And while Ebenezer no longer exists, it does have a story to tell. And we've got two amazing guests here today to help us with telling that story. She is an assistant professor of history at Brigham Young University, where her research focuses on the German settlers of the colonial Atlantic, and in 2014 earned a PhD in history from NYU, writing her dissertation on the Salzburgers of colonial Georgia. And she has taught at BYU, Utah Valley University, as well as NYU. Dr. Karen Allman, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
He is a professor emeritus of religion at Augsburg University in Minnesota, and he's one of the leading researchers in the world on the letters of Pastor Johann Martin Boltzius, one of the original settlers in Ebenezer. And he earned a doctorate of theology from the University of Munich. Dr. Russell Cleckley, hello, and thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me. Good to be with you.
So to understand Ebenezer, we first have to understand why the Salzburgers left Europe in the first place. So, Dr. Cleckley, if you can you give us the elevator pitch, as it were, as to why the Salzburgers left?
Okay, well, long story short, 1731, Archbishop Firmian decides to issue an edict. Either the Protestants who were living in that territory could convert to Catholicism, or they could leave. Property owners were given up to 3 months to settle their affairs and leave. Those who didn't own property were given 8 days to convert or leave. Remarkable part of the story is some 20 to 22,000 Protestants living in that territory made the decision to leave. So the question is, where were they going to go? The majority of them were actually settled in Prussia as they made their way from the territory of Salzburg north. But this is where Karen's work really then picks up, with how it is that some 300, give or take, were given the opportunity then to settle in Georgia, because kind of an interesting question, why would they end up crossing the Atlantic to go to Georgia?
And my ancestors were the settlers that came to this area from Salzburg, Austria. They were forced out of their country in 1733 because of their religious beliefs. Archbishop Firmian wanted everyone to be Catholic, but the Salzburgers wanted to follow Martin Luther's teachings and be Lutheran. Archbishop Firmian gave them the ultimatum, my religion or leave. He gave them 8 days to leave. If they owned property, he gave them 3 months. 20,000 Salzburgers left their homeland because of their religious beliefs.
And so it wasn't 20,000 Salzburgers that came to Georgia, right?
No, most of them went to East Prussia. A few went to Holland.
Why they chose to go to America is something I thought about a lot, because it was arguably a much more risky decision than traveling across a continent and going to live in Prussia. And, you know, they were intercepted. They were coming out of Salzburg, and they were in Augsburg and other towns around that. And the Lutheran ministers in that area were already part of a philanthropic network with a bunch of English aristocrats called the SPCK, Society for Promoting Christian Knowledge. And that it all happened at the time that several of those SPC British members were also working to found the colony of Georgia. And so they got the idea, what if we intercept some of these poor, they always called them poor persecuted Protestants. That was the phrase they used. They said, what if we intercept them and we make them a deal to go to America to this brand new colony? Why they went, I think part of it is that America by the 1730s already had a reputation among Germans anyway of being a place where they could practice their religion. They call it the English liberties. We have to remember also that Great Britain was ruled by a German king. King George II was a German. He was also the Elector of Hanover. So there were already a lot of connections. So I think, you know, they also negotiated pretty hard through the Lutheran ministers in Augsburg with the SPCK to make sure that they would be taken care of. And they signed a document even. And one of the things the British promised them is that they would get ministers, that they would fund to have ministers go with them. And so they really, you know, they didn't just leap for joy and say, we're going to America. It was something that they really considered and negotiated and made sure that they were going to get land and supplies and ministers and have the right to practice their religion, et cetera. But in the end, why does anyone go to America? Why do any of these people go to America?
Right.
Usually for economic reasons, quite honestly. They think they'll have a better chance there.
But in England, the king makes a special request or special offer for the folks in Salzburg. And the king has exactly the idea where he thinks these Salzburgers should go. And that's the brand new colony over across the Atlantic Ocean, the new colony of Georgia. The Salzburgers are led by a pastor, Johann Boltzius. He takes up King George on his offer. They board a ship. They first stop in Rotterdam, but they head across the ocean to the new colony of Georgia. Everybody on that ship knows it's going to be a dangerous voyage. The pastor, Johann Boltzius, he says we are going into danger, but closer to God.
Getting the invitation is one thing, but actually getting here, nearly 5,000 miles and a whole ocean away and setting up shop, well, that's a whole different thing entirely. And they first arrived in 1734, and this is nearly 40 years before the start of the American Revolution. And it's actually about 5 miles up the road that they start building the first version of Ebenezer.
This is completely non-academic, but two experiences that I have that always sort of make it clear in my own mind what they were facing is a lot of times when I'm driving into Georgia, I'm driving from South Carolina on I-95. When I'm heading from north to south on the bridge over the Savannah River, if you're here, if your listeners ever have an opportunity to do this, when you're driving across that bridge, it only works if you're going north to south, but take a look to your right, heading south over that bridge, and look up the river, and you will see hardly any human artifacts at all there on the river. That's what that would have looked like to these settlers coming up the river. Of course, as Karen said, they were coming by land, but just kind of to give you an impression about what the landscape looked like.
And if you want a better sense of what the Salzburgers were facing, our team went to the original site of the town of Old Ebenezer for the video series.
The first attempt to settle Ebenezer does not go well at all. The area is prone to flooding. The land that they're on is not conducive to growing food, and having food is essential. So this is not going to go well. This is just the beginning of their problems because we've got disease coming up. And within the first years of this colony, about half the people died. They're trying hard for 2 years. But there's not a lot of redeeming qualities about it. And at this time, Georgia is being led by a British general, James Oglethorpe.
James Oglethorpe is the name in early Georgia. He's also the namesake of Oglethorpe University. King George, back in England, has tapped James Oglethorpe to be the guy to run things here in Georgia. And it's pretty clear after 2 years that things aren't going to work in Ebenezer. So the Salzburgers go to Oglethorpe for some help.
And they say, hey, look, we need a better place to live. We can't stay in this place. And Oglethorpe is receptive. And he says, okay, I'll move you.
The move actually solved some of Ebenezer's problems. But it didn't solve all of them. Because what ultimately helped the community survive wasn't the actual land. It was the people.
One thing I think that was distinctive about them, as opposed to in Savannah, is that they did have this close sense of a community, and they did work together. And so, for example, land, rather than divide it up on a grid as the trustees wanted, they kind of overlaid on top of that so that each household would get some good land and some bad land. Because if you did it the way the trustees wanted, somebody might get lucky and somebody else will have just all sandy soil, right? So they did things like that. There's also, you can't ignore the religious element. So their pastor, Boltius, really framed their experience as being similar to the Israelites in the wilderness, you know, as a place that they will be tested and tried by God, but they'll be brought through it if they're faithful and if they endure it well, you know, that it's, so it's both it is a wilderness to them, this pine forest, but it's also a spiritual level kind of wilderness.
The settlers even had a term for this period of adjustment, working through the diseases and so on, this period of seasoning, of just getting acclimated. And you would expect when you come that you're going to go through this. You're going to encounter these diseases, malaria, dysentery. And even once you got to the point where you could be fairly certain you're going to survive it, the implications of having these diseases could follow you for the rest of your life. Boltzius continued to struggle with recurring bouts of malaria throughout his entire life until he died in 1765. So it's not just a one and done kind of thing. This kind of persists for a while.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, Russell, Karen makes a good point about sort of, you know, the struggle from a spiritual perspective. Everything that I have read is Boltzius's approach was sort of like the struggle is part of the process here, right?
That's right, yeah.
You know, like this is where y'all signed up for this. This is part of the deal. My question to you is what do we know about Boltzius sort of as a person? You know, he is one of the first leaders of this group, right? Obviously he is their pastor. Mm-hmm. But was there a lot sort of laid at his feet in terms of like leading infrastructure and, I mean, I say government, but you know, the early phase of organization and building this out? Or was he sort of like just in the corner of, he was just the pastor, but he's the name that sort of emerges?
I think that was part of the real struggle for him was, of course, he views everything through this sort of religious, theological lens, you know, shaped by this hollow pietism outlook that he had been educated and trained in. So that means certain things for him personally, but then he also had to translate that into a leadership role. And I think one of the most difficult things for him was that while he felt prepared to lead his people pastorally, to lead them through the secular aspects of their life, the civic dimensions that were required to create a town, to create a community, and as sort of naturally withdrawn as Boltzius could be, the place where he would be willing to make a stand and even to stand up to somebody as formidable as Oglethorpe was when the welfare of his people was at stake, that he would toe the line there. And didn't happen often, but when it happened, it was very forceful, and you can see it emerge in his leadership.
They moved here in 1736. Pastor Boltzius realized there were many widows and children. So one of the first buildings that they built was the first orphanage. George Whitfield brought the first bell.
And you're actually about to ring them right now.
Yes, ring them every Sunday morning.
Okay.
Before the worship service at 11 o'clock. Because bells were very important.
Why?
Because if you had meetings, they would ring the bells.
If you had
an emergency.
We get in contact and notify each other by texting, and their way of doing that was by ringing a bell.
So the first bell came in 1740. And in fact, George Whitfield fashioned his orphanage at Bethesda in Savannah after our orphanage here at Ebenezer.
What's interesting to me is that, you know, when it comes to sort of setting up a, you know, putting a settlement together, an orphanage is not the first thing that I think of in terms of what they're going to need. So I guess I'll start with you, Karen. Why was that the thing that they needed early on? It doesn't strike me as something that, you know, the community needs right out of the gate.
Well, a few things. First of all, the Franca Foundations, where Boltzius trained, is famous for its orphanage. And it's not an orphanage in the way we might think of them today. It was a school. It was a place to teach people, right? And to take people in. And not all the student residents were actually orphans. They were just poor or something like that, right? So it was a communal way to care for the poor and the needy. They hired an elderly Salzburger couple to run it, the Koglers, and they, you know, they couldn't do the super hard labor, but they could run this orphanage, right? So he's implementing the model that he knows from Halle, and you've seen it work in Halle. And the community, it's kind of, I would almost think of it more like a community center. It's an orphanage, it's a place for poor people. It's a school. The trustees sent an educator with the first group. Ortman was his name. They sent a teacher with the very first group. So they needed a place for them to meet. So it became kind of the center of town.
Russell, I'll turn to you for this one. You know, we've been to Ebenezer a couple times, and you know, we've spent some time in that church and kind of walked around there. What can you tell me about when that church is first built? I mean, when you look at the history of that church, it's been a number of things, right? It's been a stable. It was a hospital during the Revolution. I mean, it's been a number of things and still going today. What can you tell us about sort of the early, the building, when they start putting, you know, putting things together and they build this thing out that's now, you know, 300 years later, still standing strong?
Yeah. Well, of course, this wasn't the first church structure in Ebenezer. The first one happens when Karen, around 1741, really around this time you were just referring to, where a lot of the infrastructure of the community begins to take shape. It was a wooden structure, and it also served as a time as a place to hold school, community center, and so on. You know what the climate is like in that part of Georgia. Very humid. Wood structures just don't last very long. And so there was constant repair having to take place. And so it became obvious that if they're going to have a permanent structure, it needs to be made out of something other than wood. So Boltius actually starts to initiate this project towards the end of his life. Even makes a donation towards the construction of it, but doesn't live to see it.
This church took 2 years to build in 1767 and completed in 1769, as you can see on the clock. Where the roof comes up to the point, it's inscribed on the brick, 1769.
I love all the cool little touches. The swan at the top.
And do you notice that the swan has a bullet hole through it? During the Revolutionary War, a British soldier shot a hole through the swan.
Oh, my goodness.
The Salzburgers built the church out of handmade bricks from the clay that was found nearby. But here you see, there's the handprint.
And this is from an original Salzburger
child.
Well, I want to see the inside. Can we go check that out?
Yes, you may.
Awesome. Stepping into a time machine here with Miss Patsy.
Yes, come in.
Oh my gosh. This is so cool.
During the Revolutionary War, the British camped here. They camped at New Ebenezer. And the church was used actually as a hospital and a stable for their horses.
Were the Salzburgers largely considered patriots?
Some were loyalists and some were patriots.
Okay.
Yes.
So it seems a little bit complicated.
Yes. That was a time that the church was almost destroyed. A lot of the congregation members moved farther away.
You know, Ebenezer at some point really does sort of start to flourish, right? It's the county seat of Effingham County. There is, you know, a judicial system there. There is a school. It is sort of the crossroads of commerce and everything there in the county. At some point, it's even got the state legislature operating out of there for a short period of time. So I'm curious, do we know when the decline is the only word I can think of? But, you know, it's sort of this like up, it peaks, and then things start to go south, because obviously Ebenezer is no longer. What do we know about when Ebenezer starts to sort of crest in terms of its peak, of its powers, so to speak?
Karen, I'm going to defer to you again on that because of your work, but
I think they really thrived under the trustee rule. Because they embodied the trustees' goals for the colony, this community working together, small family farms, not big plantations. The trustees did not want to replicate what was going on in South Carolina. They wanted small family farms. So they really did well under the trustee regime, as opposed to the other English settlers in Georgia. And when the trustees surrendered their charter, and became a royal colony in the 1750s, they had much less political sway because now they didn't have, you know, Bolsius always had a direct line, right, to the trustees and to, you know, and he didn't quite have that anymore. They still had a lot of supporters. But I personally, after studying it, I think, you know, sort of two things explain why Ebenezer is no more. The first is the shift in Georgia to a plantation economy. That results, as it did everywhere else, it results in a real concentration of wealth among a smaller group of people. And then there's a large base of poor people. And the Salzburgers, most of them were self-sufficient, but they were never going to be wealthy enough to buy into that kind of economy, right? So you see them selling their lands and becoming, so that economic model just didn't work for them because they weren't wealthy enough to participate or to compete with large landowners coming from South Carolina who wanted to buy up and start plantations. The other thing is, I think, the American Revolution. And those two forces created rifts in the community as people chose sides. So some Salzburgers saw an opportunity in plantation economy and tried to jump on that, right? And a way to accumulate wealth much quicker. And some Salzburgers sided with the Patriot cause and some with the British, you know, as loyal British citizens. And so that really cleaved the community and it really shrunk the congregation at the church there. And then you have to remember by the time of the revolution, people were living, they were going to church in Ebenezer, they were coming into town, but they weren't living in town for the most part.
Yeah.
So when the town is destroyed by the British and the Americans, there's not a lot of impetus to rebuild it.
I agree with everything that Karen said. I think there are at least two other factors that are going on. One that is simply just general to immigrant communities. There's a certain pattern that they follow over a period of time as people who are original settlers. That story translates into generations that follow. They tend to disperse and spread as people become just more and more comfortable with being an American community, not simply an immigrant community anymore. And so they tend to disperse naturally. I think that part of the story of Ebenezer, along with the sort of internal division that the community experienced and the devastating results of the American Revolution, is it just outlived its purpose. It fulfilled its purpose and outlived it. It outlived its usefulness. As people simply moved away. So the story doesn't end, but it changes. And the economic forces begin to spread outside the epicenter of Ebenezer and to spread out.
During the revolution, Ebenezer, like a lot of places, is quite literally going through a tug of war. Control of the settlement flips back and forth between the Patriots and the British a few times, actually.
And by the time we get to 1782, the war has been going on for a while, but Savannah is still under the British control. And so they're gonna have to move the capital of Georgia again. Anthony Wayne has his headquarters in Ebenezer. The legislature starts to meet there. And so, for all intents and purposes, for a brief period of time, this town that struggled for so many years becomes the capital of Georgia. By 1796, Ebenezer is now the county seat of Effingham County. So it's the seat of commerce, it's a seat of government, people are traveling through the town, and it gains importance. Now, some would say that this time is the time when Ebenezer is at its high water mark. It really starts to decline, and we can say it for sure, when the county seat moves from Ebenezer to Springfield in 1799. So the courts move, the businesses move along with it, people aren't traveling through the town anymore, and so Ebenezer basically becomes like a ghost town.
Ebenezer is often described as a ghost town. But that's only true if you're talking about the town itself. The people remained. Descendants of those original Salzburgers still live in Effingham County. And every Sunday, nearly three centuries after a group of religious refugees crossed an ocean looking for a place to worship freely, services are still held in the church they built. The town may be gone. The legacy is not. Marked the Podcast is written and hosted by me, Andrew Iden, and produced and edited by the GPB podcast team, Jeremy Powell, Miranda Hawkins, and Mark Davenport. And Sandy Malcolm is the Senior Vice President of Content.